Good evening. We are going to start off again with a short presentation by Melissa Kane, who's going to talk about the third party factor in this election. Welcome, Melissa Kane, please.
Thank you. All right. Where's my clicker? Okay. All righty. So thank you, everyone. We're just going to take a few minutes before the other panelists get on stage and talk about third-party runs, because it's something we hear a lot about and want to talk through some of the data, some of the myths. We're going to agree with some of them. We're going to dispel a few of them. But at the end of the day, I'm not going to hide the ball from you. I think that what you're going to see through the data is that it is probably not a good idea for Donald Trump to run as a third-party candidate, which doesn't mean he won't. But it does mean that it would probably not be a good idea. But what the sort of better idea, or maybe the more plausible scenario, is for an establishment candidate to actually run as a third-party candidate should Trump get the nomination. And we're going to talk about why that is and how that works out. All right, so today we're going to just define a few terms. I'm going to talk through, there are about four ways to get on the ballot. People don't realize there are actually lots of ways to get on the ballot, about four different ways to get on the ballot. And then I'm going to explain to you the establishment spoiler, the little part of that thing called the U.S. Constitution that none of us have read since sixth grade. And we're going to go through a little bit of that. So number one, when we talk about elections, we're talking about the general election. I know the primary is coming up. That's what we're all thinking about. But remember, today we're just talking about the November election. And we're also talking about electors this time, not delegates. And we're also going to be talking about outsider versus insider. We're just really talking about sort of establishment versus anti-establishment. Because on the Democratic side, there doesn't seem to be much of a stomach for a third party run. Okay, so we're going to sort of put those aside. And so today we're going to talk about the tension within the Republican Party between outsider, insider, establishment, anti-establishment. Okay, so there are four ways to get on the ballot. Number one is to create your own party. Just call it a Trumpublican party and just say, and go through, and you have to submit signatures and you have to submit some documents to your state, to your Secretary of State to do this, but it can be done. Now, here's the problem. The states you see there in yellow represent about 190 electoral college votes. Those are states where the deadline to sort of create your Trumpublican party has passed by the time the GOP convention is held, right? So if you decide, if he were to decide, or anyone were to decide at the convention, I don't like how this is going, I'm going to do my own thing, you've already forfeited 190 electoral college votes, right? So the states in orange are the states where you could still try to get your Trumpublican party on the ballot after that. So the bottom line there is you got to start early if you want to go down this road. And the great thing about this option is that the party doesn't have to name its candidate. You could just put the party on there as a placeholder, right? And then name your candidate later. And that's why this is good. This would actually be really good leverage to hold over a convention if someone were thinking to do that, to say, if you don't elect me, I'm just going to put my name on my Trumpublican Party ballot in all of these states and forget it. So that's the benefit of this. Again, is sort of you don't have to name your candidate right away. But again, the downside is that the deadlines are really against you if you don't decide until the convention. All right, so the next way to be on the party is maybe my favorite, and because it really relies on the efforts of other people, is to hitchhike with another party. There are actually a couple of parties that are already on the ballot. With Californians, when we go to our ballot, there's Peace and Freedom Party, there's Libertarian Party, there's other parties aside from Republicans and Democrats. So a Republican candidate or conservative candidate could try to hitchhike along with, for example, the Constitution Party. Now, this is a sort of Christian-based, very conservative party. They're on the ballot in about 17 states, representing about 150 delegates. So the red states you see there are states that the Constitution Party is already on. The yellow states is where they're trying, and the purple states are where they're suing. And so that's America. This is what we do. So there's the Constitution Party. That's an option, right? If you wanted to get on, you could just convince those guys to let you on. And this is the Libertarian Party. Okay, so they're on even more states, 32 states, and they have access to about 332 electoral votes already. Problem with the Libertarian Party is it would take a lot of sweet talking. Let's face it, to be like, I woke up this morning and I decided
deep down, I'm really a libertarian. And I decided all this the day after the Republican convention, where I was really mad. And it was a coincidence. And anyway, I'm really a libertarian. Please let me be on your ballot. It would take a lot of sweet talking. But the biggest problem with the hitchhike scenario, which again is still in the works, is that the Constitution Party picks their presidential nominee in April, and the libertarians do it in May. And so that ship has sailed a bit if you wait until the GOP convention. Okay. So the third way to be on is to run as an independent. And that's really kind of what we think about when you hear people talking about an independent run, a third party run. This is somebody who's just running that's like just like your name, just Mitt Romney. That's it. Like not any sort of party affiliation at all, just that particular name. And this is the one where you often hear experts say it's too late to try. Right? It's just a ship of sail. And they're kind of right. If you want to win 270 electoral votes, it is probably too late to try. But we're going to talk about why that might not be the case. If you look, for example, in the red states there, those are states where the deadline to run as an independent will have elapsed by the day of the convention. So again, if you show up at the convention and you say, I'm going to take my toys and go home, I'm just going to run as an independent, you've already forfeited 159 electoral votes. All right. And then to make matters worse, in August, so like 2 weeks after the convention is over, you have to then produce thousands of signatures in order to get on the ballot. So even those blue states that you see there who represent August, those are states where you have to turn in a bunch of signatures in order to get on the ballot. So again, very, very difficult. And if you look here, why am I pointing over there? Okay. This is a map showing sort of signature requirements. For example, Tennessee, it's like 200 signatures to be on the ballot. Like, we could all be on the ballot in Tennessee. But then California, it's more than 170,000 signatures to be on the ballot. So it really varies. But in total, you'd need almost a million signatures to get on the ballot in every state. It's a big undertaking. And again, one you'd have to start like right now if you wanted to do it. So when you hear people say, oh, it's too late to run as an independent, they're kind of right. Again, if you wanted to win 270 electoral votes, this ship is going to have sailed by the convention. Okay. And the last way to do this, this is sort of the easiest and the hardest way, is to run as a great American write-in. Okay, and so some states don't allow write-ins at all. If you write in a candidate, they will ignore it. Now, but those are very few. They only represent about 50 electoral college votes. Then there are states where you don't have to do anything to be on the ballot as a write-in. You can do like whatever it is, they're going to count it. Donald Duck, we'll count it. We'll just find. Well, he's the winner. He's the winner. There are no requirements. So there's actually a pretty low threshold in a number of states to even be a write-in. And then for states that do require some kind of registration, and it's just like a one-page thing. Like this is super easy stuff. But the deadlines are in, as you can see, green and blue represent September and October. So if you look at the maps, see there's a lot of green and blue. The majority are in September, October. So if you were mad at the convention, this might be a really good way to go because you could still try and do a sort of ground game to get your write-in votes, although that gets tricky with the electric voting machines. But anyway, so that's the fourth way, again, to be on the ballot. So to recap, if you wait until the convention, it is almost impossible to get 270 electoral college votes as a sort of non-Democrat or Republican candidate. But that might not actually be your plan. And that's where we get into something I call the establishment spoiler. All right, so you need 270 electoral college votes to win. If no one gets 270 electoral college votes, no one is the president. Okay, if you get 269, you don't get any credit for being super popular. 270 is it, and if you don't get it, then you're not the president. So if an independent candidate were to get in and do just enough to prevent anyone else from getting 270, no one is the president. Okay, so what happens? How fun. And scary and weird, but okay. So what happens if no one gets those 270 votes? Are you going to love this? The House of Representatives decides. Congress, right? They're smart and awesome. We love them, right? I know. Now, I went to Georgia Public School, but I cannot be the only person surprised by this piece of information. So the House of Representatives actually gets to vote. And just so you know, the Senate elects the vice president. The House represents the president, elects the president. So here's two other weird things about it. With the House, if this were thrown into chaos and the House were stuck electing the president, there are two things you should know. Number one, they have to choose from the candidates who actually ran, right? They can't just say, John Zipperer, you are amazing. Please save our country and be our president. Sadly, you have to have actually been a candidate. And number two is, you're going to love this, Californians, every state gets one vote, right? So the one dude, the one congressman from Wyoming, same vote as like our entire congressional delegation. OMG. Okay, so needless to say, this kind of thing was negotiated by Rhode Island when the Constitution was being written. And that is not, that's totally true. Okay, so each state gets a vote. Now, if you look at the states, and by the way, it's the current Congress. It is not the one that's fixing to come in. It's the one that is sitting in November, December this year who would decide. All right, so if you look right now, the GOP sort of is the majority of majority of the House of Representatives, in 33 states. They're all the red ones. The blue ones are dominated by Republicans. All right, so let's go back to our hypothetical. You have Hillary Clinton, you have Donald Trump, and you have this establishment candidate, sort of third party independent person. Like, let's say Mitt Romney, or maybe somebody else who might be popular in the House of Representatives. Anyone have an idea? Maybe Paul Ryan. All right, so Paul Ryan, you got a Paul Ryan, Donald Trump, and Hillary Clinton walk into a bar. They walk into the House of Representatives. Who is the House going to vote for? Right, it ain't Hillary, and it ain't Trump. Right, it throws it back to Paul Ryan, and that is how if Trump were to get the nomination, the establishment could run a third party and cobble together between the write-in votes and maybe some of those late deadlines on those independent races. They could cobble together enough ballot presence to be on enough states to just prevent the other candidates from getting those 270 votes, and in that way actually end up winning. Now, would it be a fiasco? Yes. Would people be like, would it be bananas? Yes, I don't think anyone wants this to be the scenario, by the way. But you can bet if the convention comes and Trump is actually the nominee, there are going to be some relatively desperate people who are saying, you know what, if this is our only hope to throw this to the House of Representatives and hope that they will like us better, then that is certainly an option. Now, if you're Trump and you want to do this, understand, I think, and again, it's not, I predicting Trump is like not a thing any of us should do, but if he's actually doing the calculations, a third party, he might threaten a third party run, but the truth is, if he did, it would be too late to win outright. So all he would do, it would be to either throw the election to Clinton, confirming a lot of people's conspiracy theories about him, or throw it to the establishment candidate, whoever robbed him at the convention. So it's a less likely scenario. The thing to look out for, actually, when we talk about third party and independent candidates, is actually an establishment candidate running to throw this to a more friendly place. And I don't think any of this is what the founding fathers had in mind necessarily, but it is a possibility. So when you read about it, when you hear these things, that's the data, and that is the more likely scenario when it comes to sort of third party or independents. All right. Yeah, that's it. All right. Thank you.
Well, thank you, everybody. Welcome to Week to Week, the political roundtable from the Commonwealth Club of California from Monday, April 4th, 2016. This, of course, most recently was the weekend when just days after she warned that immigrants were being lured to this country by free soccer balls and teddy bears, Sarah Palin, who else, tweeted a photo of herself over a freshly killed brown bear in an appeal to Wisconsin voters to support Donald Trump. This is true. So Sarah Palin's back in the news. Don't worry, we're here to help you get through it. Thanks for joining us here in San Francisco. I'm John Zipper, your host for Week to Week and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. On today's program, obviously, we're going to be talking about a lot of the presidential news, the race that's winding its way along the presidential trail coming to California. So this is we're in an exciting period here. But we'll also talk about some state and local stuff, elections, as well as the new minimum wage that was just passed. You saw the governor signed it today. And other political news. As always, I note that the Commonwealth Club has people of a wide variety of views. We welcome that. We love it. But any views that are expressed up here are those only of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. And by the way, this is true. Today is National Hug a News Person Day. Bring it right here. We'll try to stay within the bounds of propriety, but we'll just welcome them to our stage. So let's meet our panelists today. I'm going to start on the far end. You've already heard from Melissa Kane. She's a political analyst. A political analyst with CBS San Francisco. She's also the host of The Cheat Sheet, and she's an attorney. She's on Twitter at MelissaKane1. Next to her is Carson Bruno, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, where he specializes in California politics and policy. He's on Twitter at CarsonJFBruno. And next to me is Joe Garofoli, senior political writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. And guess what? He's on Twitter at Joe Garofoli.
Thank you for that smattering.
It's always good when you bring your family.
They would have booed.
Listen, there are question cards spread throughout the room. I think most of you know how we do it. Write down your question, and we'll have the cards picked up, and I will try to ask as many as I can during this program. So on to our roundtable. Let's start in my home state, Wisconsin. The Wisconsin primary election takes place tomorrow. In fact, hello to my mother, who will be listening to this on podcast. She is going to be spending all day tomorrow, starting at like 6 in the morning, running a voting precinct at the St. Paul Methodist Church in Green Bay. So
good for her.
Yes. That I consider indirectly I'm helping the electoral effort here. Anyway, in Wisconsin, something strange is happening. We were chatting about this before the program. Some of you may have heard conservative talk radio, which had so long been a very powerful movement in the country, has been hurting of late. They've been losing listeners. They've been losing advertisers. In Wisconsin, there are some conservative talk radio hosts who, A, are quite popular there, and B, have been having quite an impact, it looks like, on the primary race there on the GOP side. So I'm going to start with you, Joe, because you used to work there, live there, and work there in the Cheesehead State. What do you make of the Charlie Sykes interview with Donald Trump? Do you know what I'm talking about? Again, his family. Thank you for coming.
Yes, yes. Well, first of all, Wisconsin's a place that usually goes with the front runners. And this time they're kind of veering away from that. And their Cruz is out in front on the Republican side. And Bernie Sanders has a slight lead on the Democratic side, sort of too close to call, though. But talk radio is very powerful there. It was particularly in southeastern Wisconsin, where Milwaukee is, Racine and Kenosha and all those places. And so usually talk radio folks, they don't, you know, they want to make their marks and differentiate themselves. But there, they're agreeing on one thing. We all hate Trump. And Sykes, it was probably about a 17, 18-minute interview, and it was one of the more pointed ones that that Trump has endured, and that he gave him no quarter. He pushed back on a lot of stuff. He called him a fraud. He called him out on his decorum. He said, "Wisconsin, we don't do that kind of stuff." And Charlie Sykes, he's been around there since we lived there, yeah. 25, 30 years ago. So he's an institution. Mark Belling is also another talk show host there, and he's more of the a Michael Savage approach, if you will. He called Trump, I don't think he got an interview, but he called him like a big wuss. And so that's the type of level we're dealing with him. But he's more of like a rabble rouser, that type of thing. Anyways, all these folks have come together and they're largely, maybe not largely responsible, but they have a decent hand in pushing folks towards Cruz. Not that these guys all like Cruz, but he's the leading alternative to Trump.
Carson, what do you make of what's going on there? Because Trump seems not to be connecting in Wisconsin, even though he has connected in a number of different types of states.
I've seen a few different kind of hypotheses out there. One being that actually, if you look at the polling in Wisconsin, you find that Republican voters in particular, but voters on a whole, mm-hmm. are much more kind of happy with how things are going. They're not as pessimistic about the direction of the country, of their state. They seem to think that their finances are doing okay or doing better than average. So that kind of goes against the grain of what Trump is saying, where everything's terrible, America's losing, and we need to make it a great again. So I feel like that
isn't
helping.
If the Packers have a good season, basically things are okay.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Well,
you think I'm joking.
that's not far from the truth. Yeah.
So I think that has a big portion going on in the state. And then plus, I think the Never Trump movement is starting to actually work in that sense that it's starting to convince a lot of people that anything is better than Trump. Start to look at the other two candidates, in this case, Cruz and Kasich, and figure out which one you like and vote for that person. I think it helps now that Rubio is out of the game, mm-hmm. that you have two very different kind of approaches to the Republican Party in Kasich and Trump, Cruz. Yeah. And that allows kind of the two wings of the party to really start to coalesce around the two candidates that they may like the best, which really will hurt Trump when it comes down to the numbers.
Melissa, Wisconsin, is that going to be a pivotal state then for the GOP race?
I saw someone on Twitter call it the Cheddar Wall. We can always bring it around to cheese when it comes to Wisconsin. We really can. Will it be pivotal? Not necessarily. I mean, remember, the next election is New York, and Trump is polling like 30 points ahead in New York. Clinton is polling like 12 points ahead in New York. And don't get me wrong, the New York primary is April 17th, so that's like an eternity between the two. So anything could happen, but it's likely that once you get back to the East Coast, back to New York, and then after that it's Pennsylvania and Maryland, back to sort of the backyards where the front runners, I think, are a little more comfortable. I don't know that Wisconsin's going to necessarily knock everybody off. Although for Trump, it really does matter. I mean, he really needs those Wisconsin delegates. Clinton, she can kind of, if it's a close race, remember, it's for Democrats, it's proportional. He gets 50, I get 40, fine. It's fine for her, but Trump really needs those. I think that could really make the math a little harder. And of course, at the end of the day, whenever he loses, it's terrible. As a Californian, I get excited because it means we're more important, right? He needs us more, the less he gets elsewhere. So, it's always exciting for us. So if he doesn't do as well, he actually, has to focus more on California, which, hey, I'm down with. The other thing I do want to point out, I don't know if you guys heard of this Charlie Sykes interview, like my favorite thing about this interview is that, so Trump had a list of about a dozen judges that he was thinking of making Supreme Court justices or proposing to be Supreme Court justices. And one of them was Sykes's ex-wife. And Trump had no idea. He had no idea that he was doing this interview with the ex-husband of like one of his justices. And Sykes just went to town on him. It was like, somebody gave you a piece of paper. Like, you have no idea what's even on that list. Like, it was bananas. So it was just like a really big gap. It's, for me, it's like the thing I remember most about the interview was just like...
It brings to mind David Brooks, the conservative New York Times columnist, line about Trump, that he's running for, Abraham Lincoln's office with all of the preparation that most of us put toward buying a sofa.
Right.
Yeah. Not taking it seriously, and it is a very important thing. Sticking with Trump for just a little bit more, he got into, got into a controversy. He's always in a controversy. He got into yet another controversy when he made a comment in response to, was it a Chris Matthews interview about, yes. And he was asked about abortion. Mm-hmm. And should women, if abortion is illegal, should the woman be punished? And he responded that basically, yes, somehow they should be punished. He got criticized, obviously, I mean, really across the board from pro-life groups, from the left. It seemed to have, and again, maybe it's just in light, I mean, it happened around the same time he's been beaten up by Charlie Sykes in Wisconsin,
right.
But it seemed to stick to him a bit, whereas in the past, if he says something that a lot of people disagree with, that kind of helped him, you know?
Yeah, I think that the difference was here is, one, you had the thing that he said that was offensive to women, but then it also, since abortion is such a core issue for Republicans, to not have your answer down on that one is like, kind of Republican 101. Right. And so it goes to, it kind of went to his preparedness on this, you know, to the sofa buying formula. And he is not prepared. He's not done. There's been no evidence that he spent a lot of time, you know, crafting policy papers and thinking about what he thinks about. So it was kind of an illustration of that, and it was in combination with something that's offensive to, you know, many women and men.
I think it goes to show. I mean, if you think about that interview, I forget who he did it with a while back, but he basically called himself very pro-choice. These might not be his exact words, but basically it was the gist of it all. And then he kind of shifts all the way to a very extreme, you know, position on abortion. And it kind of, I think it reinforced that, again, he has no ideological rudder. He's just kind of saying whatever he's saying at the time, and then he deals with it later. And I agree, on an issue like abortion, conservatives, Republicans, want you to be with them. And this kind of shows that he's not really there, or he's trying to be something he's not.
And then he had like four different answers.
Yeah. On that issue, they will figure out if you are trying to BS them or not.
And it's not just a matter of there are a lot of anti-abortion Republicans. It's that they are the ground troops of the party.
Yes.
They've built the Iowa party from ground up in recent decades. So it's like, it's not just, oh, well, we've lost some suburban Republicans, but we'll gain them in the South. They've lost the folks who are going to ensure that, you know, the elderly folks get to the voting poll and will do the phone banks and all that stuff.
Especially in these Midwestern states where, yes, there's a lot of the blue collar kind of people who have maybe voted for Democrats, but they're still socially conservative. They care about these issues, even if they might not be voting for you for president in that primary. They still care about these issues.
Well, and remember, he's been trying to go around and say, interestingly, that he would unite the party and unite America and turn some states Republican that might not be, historically. And so it really bit into that narrative when you start alienating. Like, what was 74% of women? I mean, even forget who's going to be voting in the primary, but if you look down the road to the general election, it just that plus the Heidi Cruz thing where he was tweeting, pictures of Ted Cruz's wife, just alienating large swaths like that. Peggy Noonan called it and I'm paraphrasing here, an accumulated ball of grossness. of his behaviors toward women that were just like, and so you turned off not only parts of the Republican Party, but once you see, he can't, it's harder for him to make the argument that down the road he is a viable candidate in a general election. It's harder and harder for him to make that argument when poll after poll is showing he has alienated not just Republican women, but, other women who would be voting in the general election as well. And so that's.
I mean,
part of the problem of that is it really is part of a number of other things that he's done.
He is, north of 60% unfavorable rating. I mean, in some polls, it's nearing 75%. I mean, it's impossible to etch a sketch to put that, in Mitt Romney's advisor's terminology that away. I mean, you're in such deep red territory, and red being a deficit, not Republican.
Not in a good way.
that it's impossible to claw your way out of that anymore. So I do believe he thinks he can do it still because he's completely delusional. But only he and his hardcore supporters really think that he can actually expand the map and win the majority of voters in November.
Well, so thank you, Melissa, for your presentation to begin with, because that gets into a lot of, what do the Republicans do? What does Trump do by the Republicans? What does the establishment do? What do the anti-Trump Republicans do? And then, of course, how does Trump respond? And how do other folks who maybe are watching this, who kind of, they're all doing that calculus of if this happens, that opens up this a possibility. And you mentioned, it goes to the House. Paul Ryan's there. My favorite headline of today is from USA Today. It's, quote, Paul Ryan running out of ways to say he's not a presidential candidate, unquote. is he a potential white knight, regardless of what he says? And if not him, is there someone else, or do they make their peace with Cruz? Or Trump? I mean, if you're, there are a lot of folks here who are not Republicans, but if you're a Republican, you want the party to continue and not explode. What do you do?
Well, to be clear, the Speaker of the House is usually the chairman of the convention, right? So when we talk about, for those of you who are my previous presentation, we talked about how at the beginning of the convention, you have to adopt a new set of rules, and there's all this parliamentary procedure and all this wrangling that's potentially going to be happening at the convention this year. And the Speaker is usually the chairman of the convention. He's up there with the gavel and sort of dealing with all of these votes. If there's any inkling that he has any desire or interest in being the candidate, that would be a problem, right? So he's got every incentive to at least say, no, I'm not interested, because he needs to be able to perform his duties as the chairman of the convention. So I'm not saying he's lying. I'm just saying, maybe. I'm just saying he really has a lot of incentive right now to try and pull himself out of it and pretend to be neutral, at least initially, so that he can try to sort of preside over the convention itself.
Yeah, politically, there's no answer. You can't say, yes, I'm interested. He has to say, I'm not interested. And plus, as the rules are written now, they can and will be changed a couple weeks before the convention, but he's not eligible, because you have to win 8 states, the majority of the delegates in 8 states. I mean, as the rules stand, Kasich's not eligible.
They're going to change those.
Yeah, they'll change it. Yeah. But I don't know. I think that it would already, if Trump is very close and he doesn't come out with the nomination, you're going to have a major disenfranchisement issue there, and people are going to be ticked off. If everybody, all the three major candidates are shut out, I think there's going to be a real problem. And you know, white knight or not, I mean, it looks like an episode of House of Cards and not what, you know, what's actually going to happen. Yeah. So I don't know. And of course, I'm dead wrong in public 9 times out of 10. So, but I think it's going to be one of the three. And like Priebus said, who's there?
I agree. Yeah. Really? I think it is going to be one of the three. And I think right now the RNC has kind of no good options going on for them. I mean, Trump would be a disaster. Cruz wouldn't be much better, to be honest.
No.
He runs into many of the same walls that a Trump candidacy would.
But he's more lovable, isn't he?
maybe relative to Trump.
On that scale, yes. Yeah.
If unfavorables are only at 71%, that kind
he's of... He's actually at 53%. He's the next worst. Clinton is slightly behind him. But there's just no good options available to you.
Everyone in this country in November is going to be hate voting.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely.
Yes,
definitely.
Okay.
Well, I was listening carefully to Melissa, so I just have to ask... when is it too late for John Zipperer to put his name in? consider?
April 24th.
Okay.
So you know.
Here's the thing, though, with clearly Paul Ryan also, schedule. Though. Why would he want to run this year? Why?
Yeah.
You know, he did not want to be speaker. He did. Eventually accepted it. But why would you want to be speaker during this whole ordeal? He's doing the best he possibly can out of it. But why would you want to run for president in this environment with all just the divisiveness that's going on right now, especially within your own party? Why not just wait, you know, do well for a few years in the speaker, maybe go home, run for governor, and then run? And he's young. I mean, he's, what, 40-something, 42?
Yeah, early 40s, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he has time. He does not need to be president, the presidential nominee this year.
Okay. Before we move on to some Democratic candidates, someone in the audience asked, does anyone know how Wisconsin awards its Republican delegates? Is that a winner-take-all?
Kind of. So they have 42 delegates. 18 of them go to the winner, right? Go to the sort of overall person who gets the most votes, right? So that's the 18 are sort of the winner take all. Then they also have 8 congressional districts, and each of those districts has 3 delegates. So the overall winner in each district gets those 3 delegates. So
just like California.
Exactly. Just like California. So Trump, for example, could lose a bunch of, you know, could lose statewide or lose in 7 of the districts and still get 3 delegates. So it's not the case that one person is necessarily going to get this whole bucket of delegates. It could go different ways depending on what happens in each of those 8 congressional districts.
Okay. So that's the chess game going on in the Republican Party. On the Democratic side, it's getting tighter between Secretary Hillary Clinton and Senator Bernie Sanders. What do you make? I believe it was Rachel Maddow had an interview with Bernie Sanders this week and asked him about something that sounds so arcane that most people couldn't care about it, but I think it's key. And that was, he was asked, would you consider, because he's been, you know, spectacularly successful raising money from millions of folks in small amounts, really great grassroots connections, outraising Hillary Clinton by more than $10 million, I believe, in the last month alone. And she asked him, would you consider help using your fundraising machine to help some of the down-ticket Democrats, the senators, the congressmen, the governors, and such like that? And his response was,
meh.
I'll look into it.
Yeah. Now, and the reason I say this is
It was
key,
as if it had never occurred to him.
Right.
Yeah. He was like, oh, well, that's an idea. I'll talk to my people.
So in all this talk about superdelegates, those superdelegates, a lot of them are down-ticket Democrats. So, I mean, did he just kind of basically say, I wasn't really planning on getting this far?
And it's not surprising. The guy is not, I mean, he hasn't been, he caucuses with the Democrats, but he's not been a, you know, full-fledged member of the party. So that's thinking in party terms where you raise money for other people so they come around and raise money for you. That's what he's railing against, the whole system. So it's like you're asking him to buy into the system that he's trying to lead a revolution against. So it doesn't make sense that he, you know, or it makes perfect sense that he'd be like, well, like, think about it. But the problem is, one of the major reasons he's losing is because he's losing all these superdelegates who were, as you say, members of the party. So, it was kind of a very telling moment, but not a surprising one, but it was very telling. And it's not going to get a lot more superdelegates with an answer like that.
Yeah, no.
I think what you just said, he's running a revolution, and he talks about that a lot. You know, this is a revolution. You can't run a revolution from the top down, though. I mean, those revolutions don't end up well usually in our history. You need the grassroots, and he does have an enormous amount of grassroots support. I mean, his fundraising ability really showcases that. But you have to then kind of translate that into the next step. And the next step are those down ballot races. I mean, that Democrats really kind of rail on Republicans and their success at the state level. But what they tend to forget is Republicans spent years, election cycle after election cycle of building benches at the local level to then get them to run for state legislature and then for statewide office and then for Senate, Congress, whatever. That takes a long time. And the Democrats really haven't replicated that quite yet. They're making advances. But that's something where a Sanders campaign could actually move the needle on many of the key things that he holds so dear to his heart, policy-wise. So that's why I was surprised by that. Well, that's obviously how you're going to actually keep the fire to Hillary Clinton's
build a revolution.
Feeds whenever she's in the White House.
And to be fair, Hillary Clinton is ahead even without the superdelegates.
Yes. Yeah.
So I have to ask our lawyer on the stage, Melissa. I saw a story online today, so who knows if it's true or not, but it said that the GOP delegates could be bought legally. Can you tell us what's stopping Donald Trump from just saying, vote for me, here's a big check for each and every one of you?
Yeah, there's really nothing, actually. I plan to be in Cleveland at the convention, and I would not be surprised at all to see a parking lot full of shiny brand new Teslas or whatever, or Ferraris or Humvees or whatever the hell. No, they're really, when you dig down and you start to say, okay, let's assume we have an open convention and let's assume everyone's just trying to sort of figure out who the loyalties are and get them to vote for their candidate. There's really no legal issue or there's no law that prohibits a candidate from trying to purchase, even outright, even like with a briefcase full of cash, a vote from a delegate to vote for them. And so this could be a very, very interesting scenario where you literally could have bidding, right? And you've got donors even like the Koch brothers or like Sheldon Adelson who really haven't weighed in. They've kind of kept their powder dry, who may, the possibilities are endless in terms of how this could look and how disgusting this could be at the convention. And again, if it's open, people are already going to be freaking out and feeling disenfranchised. And then if there is, again, there's legally it would be fine, but the optics of actual purchasing of delegate votes would be, 1968, Chicago. Yeah. It would be very bad, but legal.
I think this actually goes into something nicely about how Cruz is actually starting to work behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. especially in a lot of these states that are winner-take-all states. So you have Arizona and South Carolina and Florida, the kind of the big ones that are winner-take-all by state. And so Trump won all of them. Technically, those delegates are bound to him for the first ballot. After that, they're anyone's game.
Right.
But they don't select their delegates until well after. After the primary. So what Cruz's campaign has been going into these states and actually getting people who either very explicitly pledged to him, or he knows, like through the inner workings of state politics, that these people are his sort of Republicans. And so, you know, if he can get to the convention with no majority for Trump and they does get kicked to the second ballot, I wouldn't be surprised if you saw Cruz win on the second ballot or at least the third ballot.
And he's in California. He's way ahead of the game.
Yes.
They've been working on this for several months, and they have a very good operation to do this. Trump's statewide operation.
Cruz's operation here is amazing. I mean, Ron Nearing, who's the former state chair of the party, former chair of the San Diego party, is his national co-chair. He has been working this state up and down like no one else, building up his delegate ranks.
My prediction is that this GOP national convention will break all viewership. We're all going to watch it. I mean, popcorn and beer or whatever. I mean, it's going to be fascinating and fun and a little scary.
Educational,
and,
too. I mean,
no one
knows. It'll be the first time that we've really, any of us, have ever seen a truly open convention, potentially.
True.
I mean, it's looking that way. I mean, we still have some time ahead of us. But.
Well, any thoughts on... after Wisconsin, we go to New York. Anything to look for there? Anything significant? It sounds like you were saying earlier, Trump's way ahead on the Republican side.
Trump's way ahead, and Clinton's ahead, too. I think Melissa said that. But, I mean, it's like how much – I'm looking forward to the stories of, you know, people – there'll be a greater focus on stories about people who have had direct interaction with both Clinton and Trump. And as a business person and as a senator. So they'll flesh that out a little bit more, and I think we'll hear stuff that we haven't heard so far.
Do you agree, Carson, Melissa?
Numbers-wise, 50% is the key in New York for Republicans. If Trump is getting above 50% at the state level, he gets all of the delegates. At the congressional level, the same thing. It's a winner-take-all trigger at 50%. Otherwise, it's proportional. That's the number to be looking for. Can Cruz and Kasich keep him below 50%? I don't think there's any chance of either of them actually really competing for him for the wins. But can they keep him below that threshold so they can net some delegates out of it? Again, keeping him below that 1237 number. The Democrats, it could end up being an interesting race. I mean, the polling has been on a clear trajectory for Sanders in the New York polling. And granted, there's not much out there, but he's on an upward swing, and Clinton's kind of flat. So, if I were Clinton, I would be worried about New York, because if it comes, I think if even it comes close there, that kind of could create some image problems for her. And if she loses, dear God, I mean that's a terrible thing for her. but we have quite a few weeks ahead of. Before that comes around. So if she pulls off a surprise win in Wisconsin, I think she's fine in New York.
Do you agree?
Yeah, but if she doesn't, I mean, remember, so that would be four in a row that Sanders would have won, right? Three of them dramatically, and then Wisconsin will probably be close. And then he goes into New York, and if he makes it close or wins, like that kind of momentum is going to be, it's going to have an effect.
And the superdelegates are the ones paying attention to that. You know, they're not going to bail ship on the Clinton, HHS Clinton, whatever, want to call it, unless they're very clear she is kind of losing steam, something's happening, this is not going to go well, like we saw in 2008. I mean, they stuck with her until they kind of realized, oh, Obama's got this in the bag. There's no way that she's going to turn this around. And then they started bailing in droves. We're not at that point, nor do I think we're near that point yet. But losing New York... yeah, I think there are going to be a lot of reassessments at that point.
Okay, good reasons to stay tuned throughout the month. Let's move to some state and local elections. This is not the presidential race. Excuse me, is not the only thing that will be on our ballots this June here in California. Let's talk a bit about the U.S. Senate primary race. There are 31 candidates.
33.
33.
See how easy it is to get on the ballot.
Yeah. A lot of folks. Dr. Larry Gersten, frequent week-to-week panelist and also an NBC Bay Area political analyst, he noted, so Kamala Harris has raised $9 million as of January. Loretta Sanchez, $2.7 million. On the GOP side, Duff Sundheim has $300,000 raised. Tom Delbacaro, am I pronouncing that correctly? Yeah. $188,000. Are those the four candidates that we're likely to be talking about with any shot?
Yeah, well, Ron Unz is also on the ballot. But I think he is doing it more of a to raise awareness about another issue in the fall ballot. So, and he's said that.
Okay.
So that's a major reason is the fundraising. I talked to Duff a couple of weeks ago. He goes, well, now that California is going to matter and we're going to have all this attention here because of the sort of the Trump bump. Because I'm able to hire a fundraiser now. It's like, dude, it's March.
I'm thinking of opening campaign offices.
Yeah. And those guys are, Duff's a very earnest guy, but those guys are driving themselves around. It's not a major operation. And that's hard. And the Republicans in California. And the unusual thing that may happen is that there could be, since the top two finishers, the people with the two most votes, move on to the general election, it could be two Democrats.
Republicans have a math problem in June.
Yeah.
They do. I mean, when you're talking about 33 candidates, there are 11 Republicans, there are 7 Democrats, 2 Libertarians, 1 Green, 1 Peace and Freedom, and 11 nonpartisan, MPPs. even at a very favorable kind of 40% Republican turnout, in the 2012, 2014, the non-major Republicans, they still win votes. They still get percentages. Ron Unz is going to get a good number of votes. Greg Conlin, who has run for Senate before in 2012, he ran for treasurer in 2014, he's going to get a good number of votes. Phil Wyman, a former state senator, he's going to get a good number of votes. You're starting to look at, Duff and Tom DelBacaro are going to be splitting, roughly 20 to 25% of the vote. Even if Sanchez just gets one third of Democrats, she's at 16% right there. So Republicans are in a math problem. They have to figure out a way to one of them has to figure out a way to consolidate in order to kind of get most of that 20, 22% in order for them to kind of make it into November. And it becomes harder and harder when you have semi-serious kind of non-major candidates also on the ballot.
So we're probably going to have pretty strong Republican turnout for this primary, right?
Because 15 to 30% bump because of the excitement.
Does that potentially make it more likely that one of the Republicans can get into those final two where they might not in another year?
What DelBacaro and told me, and this was very telling, he said, I don't know if there's a direct line from like the Trump voter to our campaign. So they kind of want to, they're excited about obviously having more Republicans voting, but they're not quite sure of where those are those guys going to come in and vote for just the presidential race and then I'm going to go to lunch, or do they stick around and vote through everything on the ballot? It's like many things in this election, they don't know, and even the campaigns don't know.
Right. And are they actually Republicans?
And are they Republicans?
Well, you have to be a Republican to vote in the presidential.
But are they
primary? But
recent Republicans,
exactly. Because if you are switched your party to vote against Trump, or you are newly involved, are you going to Are you actually going to vote for everything below that ballot line? And it's a big question mark. Yeah.
I think as long as they're spread out between and among so many of them, that even the increased turnout is not going to result. Yeah. To your point, you got to consolidate, or else they're not going to be able to compete, even with Loretta Sanchez.
Yeah, I mean, and 33 candidates—that's a—that's a lot of people to kind of sieve through to figure out who am I going to vote for here. I mean, that's a big ballot.
It is
a big ballot.
We're used to them around here, though.
Yeah, that's true.
Speaking of other things that are going to be on that giant ballot, there are some measures, not a ton of them, but there are some. One is kind of interesting, Measure AA. I believe it's called Clean and Healthy Bay Ballot Measure. Is that it?
Yeah.
Carson, can you tell us what that is and what its chances are?
So in June, in the 9 Bay Area counties, so San Francisco, Santa Clara, San Mateo, Alameda, Contra Costa, Solano, Sonoma, and Napa, Marin.
Wow.
We have, I was practicing that on the car ride up. You know, could I get them all? We will have a proposition on the ballot in each of those counties that will increase taxes to pay for Bay Area, or sorry, the San Francisco Bay restoration and flood protection and some other issues related to the Bay. It is interesting because it's one of those rare ballot measures that, while it's on the ballot in each county independently, it's actually a multi-county kind of coalition effort to actually make it pass. So what I mean by that is, if San Francisco votes for it, but everyone else votes against it, there's a very big chance that it won't happen at all, not even in San Francisco. So all 9 counties need to vote on it, and all 9 counties of the total vote, 2/3 need to vote in favor of it. So again, that throws another wrinkle into it. So even if, say, you know, you have Napa and Sonoma, which are only kind of tangentially attached to the actual Bay itself, if they say no, this is terrible, we don't want this, you know, this tax increase on us that, you know, really only San Francisco and a few other places are going to benefit from, if the margins are large enough in, you know, San Francisco or San Mateo and Santa Clara and Alameda and Contra Costa, then you have a chance where it could actually pass. So it's, again, it's the aggregate of all the total votes, 2/3 of that needs to move forward, not 2/3 of each county itself.
And by new taxes, we're talking $12 annually per parcel.
Yes.
And is that commercial and private?
It's a property tax measure. Okay. So they're estimating it'll raise about $500 million over 20 years. So a substantial amount that both business interests and environmental groups have actually kind of backed up behind this bill. You have, you know, the major players like the Sierra Club, and as well as the Silicon Valley Leadership Group, a major kind of chamber of commerce type organization in the South Bay. So it'll be interesting. It's one of the first times, you know, recently that this kind of multi-county effort has really moved forward. And if it is successful, it could really be a kind of a blueprint to tackle some of these other more regional issues, housing being one, mm-hmm. transportation being a very big one, especially in this area, and something that, you know, other kind of regional counties could try to experiment with in Southern California or the Central Valley.
There are some other things on the ballot locally, Measure C in San Francisco on affordable housing. San Jose has a Measure C, but it's on medical marijuana, so you don't want to get those two mixed up. probably AA is probably the big one.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, the other thing, there's a statewide ballot measure, which is going to pass with flying colors, that allows for members of the legislature to be suspended without pay. And this goes back to, of course, the Leland Yee issue, where he was allowed to, they found that there was no legal mechanism. You could either remove someone from office after they were convicted, or they just got to sit there and keep collecting their paycheck. And so Leland Yee, for example, one of many legislators who was able to continue receiving his pay while he was sort of on trial and before he was actually adjudicated guilty. So this measure, again, super popular, would sort of create this sort of suspended without pay designation so that the legislature could do that to the crooks. Whoever
the colleagues.
Alleged.
in Sacramento. So that's the other thing on the ballot as well that we're fairly confident in.
Well, let's talk about our next topic, which is something that was signed into law this morning. Governor Jerry Brown signed a bill to raise the state's minimum wage to $15 an hour in stages over the next 6 years, I believe it is. At the same time, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo signed a similar bill in that state. Perhaps of a humorous note is that Governor Brown actually physically signed this bill at the Ronald Reagan State Building in Los Angeles, so I'm sure he did that with a bit of relish. Joe, what are the politics on this? He signed it where he signed it. I'm sure he's thinking, right, this is a bit of a signature bill.
Yes. And he admitted there that he felt the pressure. There were a couple of ballot measures that were going to raise the minimum wage. He's like, well, let's get out in front of this. And there was an example where citizen pressure actually did force the legislators to move very quickly on this. I mean, it was very quick. And there's one interesting twist to this thing that the governor definitely wanted in it, even though he'll be out of office. Is that if there is a recession or there's some sort of economic downturn, it doesn't be officially a recession, the governor can call a timeout for year and say, well, we're not going to raise the minimum wage this year. But it's a one-year timeout, then they reevaluate it. And the New York wage is always, New York and California competition. But that's only for New York City, and I think they're going to phase it in around the state. Whereas in California, it's all over the state all the time.
Well, that's a good question. I'm going to ask Carson that. A minimum wage increase in San Francisco up to $15 an hour, I think people are pretty clear. Of course. It's a horrendously expensive city. In a small town somewhere else, more positive impact, more negative impact? I mean, it's going to be a different impact is what I'm getting at.
I think I'm probably the only one in this room that actually is kind of against this bill. and here's why. The issue kind of driving minimum wage increases particularly is to combat poverty. And we do have enormously high poverty in this state, particularly in this region, especially. But the minimum wage has economic impacts. It does change the nature of how you do business in this state. And in regions such as the Inland Empire, Central Valley, where wages aren't high to begin with, you're at $15 an hour, you're pushing your minimum wage up to close to 50 to 60% of what the median wage in those regions already is. And that is going to have clear negative impacts on employment in those regions, areas which are already very highly high unemployment levels. By making it a statewide kind of blanket sort of approach, you are actually making it much harder for many of the people who really need help in the state to actually find a job to be able to help pull themselves out of poverty. There are much better tools out there like the EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit, which actually are very, very efficiently target poverty. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays into effect. Now, the problem with minimum wage increases, studying them, is that they are phased in over such a long period of time. This one takes 5 years for businesses that have greater than 25 employees. For anyone that has employee level of 25 or fewer, they get an extra year to comply to each of the increases. 5 to 6 years, that's a very long time in terms of the economy. Think about over the past 5 to 6 years, what has happened in our economy. I mean, nationally, we've seen oil shocks. We've seen the European sovereign debt crisis. We've seen the implementation of the ACA, a lot of things. So how do you isolate the minimum wage increase from all this other noise going on, which makes it almost impossible for a study to really kind of pull out the effects of that minimum wage increase? So take minimum wage studies with a big grain of salt when you see them. Berkeley likes to put a lot of them out. The methodology may be absolutely correct, but the problem is how do you isolate this one actually relatively tiny piece, but has a big impact on a lot of these employers.
Melissa, your thoughts? Could it backfire on Brown and his allies?
Well, here's the thing. He's worked in this sort of stopgap, like that there's this was his big thing that he was able to negotiate into the proposal, was this idea that if we get into a recession, you could do a one-year halt. That's never going to happen. Like, think about the politics of that. Think about what the unions who are responsible for this bill would do if a future governor, I don't care who you are, said, no, we're going to pull the little brake on the minimum wage increase this year. They'd go ballistic. So I find that this whole thing is like totally illusory. And, you could love it or hate it, but this idea that he sort of negotiated in this very responsible recession thing is just like, all right, sure.
I think a Republican governor who doesn't have to rely on the union support would be
Would be... Yeah, well, you never know. You never know. 7 years is a long time.
Has he been born
Seven
yet?
7 years is a long time.
I'm not sure.
Maybe.
That's not in the between now and you know 2022 when this thing is fully implemented. Like, I don't see there being any chance of a Republican or even moderate governor who is going to actually use that break. Now, if they do, that's fine. But the whole idea, you know, that politically it would be feasible, is I don't know. I thought it just seemed to me like a kind of a thing to make people feel better, but it's not an actual break in the system.
But there is one good thing about this bill from a political sense. From a policy sense, no. But from a political sense, yes. It basically indexes minimum wage increases after 2022 to the CPI, to inflation. What that does is essentially removes this from a political debate ever again. Yeah. There is no need for the state legislature to go in and increase the minimum wage.
So I'm sure they won't.
Which they might, but they lose a lot of ammunition, and they lose a lot of the argument that the big thing is, you know, it takes the state legislature to increase minimum wage. So before 2013, it hadn't been done for, you know, 5, 6, 7 years. A lot of, you know, happens in that time period. Now there's an automatic increase based off of inflation. It kind of removes it from a political kind of perspective, which now allows us to actually start talking about policies that actually will affect and help and alleviate poverty.
Okay. Well, before we get to the news quiz, let's do a bit of a lightning round to get some of these questions in. Someone asks, do you think Donald Trump started this race as a lark, but when he saw early success, decided he really had a chance? Quickly, yes, no?
I think yes, he has a true belief. Yes and no. I mean, he's been talking about it for years, and he's tried it a couple of times. But I do get that impression, like just everything about it, from the rolling down the escalator to that first thing. Seems so pulled together at the last minute. Yeah. Like, let's put on a show, you know, type of thing that went awry. I don't know.
He does seem as surprised as anyone at his success. Yeah. Okay. And I'm not saying he's not enjoying it or he's not taking
he's totally
it seriously, but he
it,
seems
yeah.
to, he. I don't know, I get that sense from him too. They're like, you know, why don't you have an answer for abortion? I don't know, yeah. I don't think I get this far. you know,
he'll okay. be playing golf.
Okay, next question. What chance is there that the Democrats can take back the Senate in November?
High if it's Trump at the top of the ticket. I mean,
and if it's Cruz?
If it's Cruz, a little bit more difficult, but you know, it's probably a 50-50 chance at that point.
If it's Kasich?
Kasich, no. There's no chance.
If it's John Zipper?
Don't wait for the polling. Head on the head. I want to see the polling.
What side okay. or what ticket are you going to be on, John?
Rumor has it that some Republicans are working on supporting Bernie Sanders because they have all the dirt on him and can crush him. Care to comment?
I like to see those rumors. Show me some links on that.
Okay.
I like to see some Bernie Sanders dirt. Yeah. Yeah. Bernie Sanders owns stock.
I mean, polling wise.
Very good. Very good. Very good.
This tugs at my heartstrings. Any chance that someday candidates will not focus on minor issues, but big issues for the United States, like infrastructure, education, and global warming?
After this election, though.
Yeah.
No?
No.
Sorry. Okay. Well, let's do our news quiz. For those of you who have never been here before, which might be two or three of you, because I see a lot of familiar faces, I'm going to read a news quiz question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. Don't just shout it out. And I'll point to you. Then you can shout it out. If you're correct, Fran will deliver a little bag of chocolate. Some. Sorry? Ghirardelli's?
You're not going to throw it at us?
I would, but there are probably legal issues of if I hit someone in the head. I don't want to see the, you know, the tweets and the Facebook memes of people blinded by Ghirardelli chocolate bags at the Commonwealth Club. So, first question. According to New York Magazine, did a big article on this, Donald Trump has been left, quote, sweaty and spent, unquote, after campaign events because he's wearing what? Way in the back, I saw your hand first. A bulletproof vest. That is correct.
I was going to say Spanx.
You say what?
Spanx.
Sorry?
Spanx.
Okay. Here's one. We'll see
it's
how.
A bad image, by the way.
Yes. Astronomers. Astronomers say they have a plan to shoot giant lasers at faraway planets. Why would we do that, sir?
They want to hide us from aliens.
That's right. That could make us invisible to aliens, hostile aliens. Obviously, friendly aliens we'd welcome. Very good. A massive leak of data has revealed claims that political and business elites around the world have hidden billions of dollars. What is this leak called? Oh, right there in the middle.
Panama Papers.
The Panama Papers. That is correct. The oil kingdom of Saudi Arabia is reportedly building up a $2 trillion, that's with a T, T as in trillion, in fact, a $2 trillion fund to prepare for what? Actually, yes, I'm going to give it to you. They're actually preparing for the post-oil era. So right here in the front row. Alaska Air is paying $2.6 billion to purchase what other airline? I did see your hand first right in the second row, but there were a... Sorry?
Virgin
America, that's correct. Okay. On Friday... let's skip that one. It's good to be king. Here's a story. Let's see if you saw. GOP frontrunner Donald Trump, say it with me, reportedly has bombshell insider dirt on whom, ma'am?
Fox News.
Fox News. Ooh, everyone goes.
You guys hear about that?
The entire news?
It was apparently, so was it New York Magazine that wrote that broke
obviously,
it?
I was at the New York website today.
It was like the New York Observer. There's a New York-based magazine that broke basically this issue that there was a communications director for Roger Ailes who was leaving his employ. And he basically hired this really fancy lawyer. And I forget the lawyer's name. But to sort of negotiate his exit package because they got the communications director who's leaving is like, I know all the dirt on you. So... Donald Trump happens to know the fancy lawyer. And so they bring him in. This is according to the article. They bring in Donald Trump to sort of negotiate between Ailes and the fancy lawyer on behalf of the communications guy. So in the course of mediating this, Trump learns all the bombs that the outgoing communications director, who, by the way, ended up with $3 million, so he knows something. So he mediates this sort of employment dispute, and in the course of it, at least according to the article, he learned all of this really cool dirt on Roger Ailes, and so then the idea is that maybe he's using that or sitting on that somehow.
You think?
Anyway, that's
he wouldn't do that.
No.
Okay. Next question. Despite an attempt to remove it, Princeton University has said it will not remove whose name from campus building. Sir, I saw your name. You're in first.
Woodrow Wilson.
That is correct. Police in Hanover, Germany, have asked residents to stay away from windows and not to wave when what happens later this month? They're not supposed to be near their windows or wave. They're supposed to stay away from... the center of the city. Anyone want to guess?
Can a police
car pass by? No, but it does involve someone going by. Someone raise your hand and guess. Ma'am.
Hope?
Nope. Sir?
Obama?
That's right. President Obama is going to be visiting some big industrial trade fair.
And can't wave?
The good folks of Hanover have been told to basically make themselves scarce.
Be cool.
Yes. Let's see, just a couple more. The White House has said that in the summer of 2030, there could be 30,000 people killed by what? Did you see the story? They're holding a summit on this, roughly. Sir?
Climate change?
I'll give you a climate change. They're talking about a summer heat wave that could kill 30,000 people. Okay, our last one. Who spent Sunday volunteering at an Oakland, California school? These are two non-Californias. Someone raise your hand.
Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton and?
His daughter.
Bill and Chelsea Clinton, that is correct. Listen, we'll be back with more News Quiz questions and, of course, a lot more to discuss on Monday, April 21st, right here in San Francisco. And you can find our week-to-week News Quiz every Friday on Huffington Post. Thank you to our panel, Melissa Kane, Carson Bruno, and Joe Garofoli. Thanks to all of you here today, listening online, watching on TV. Have a great week.